Welcome to episode 687 with my guest, Margo Steines. You're listening to the Mental Illness Happy Hour, which is a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. Let's read some surveys. You know, I was going to do a bunch of stuff I need to... Now just get into some surveys. Shut your face. Shut your fucking face. 35 seconds in, shitting on myself. All right, let's get into it. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Emily. And she asks, are the bonus surveys on Patreon all more current, or are you going back into the archives? The only ones that I'm sometimes going back into the archives for are the shame and secret surveys. Actually, right now I'm reading ones that are current, but as I've shared before on the podcast, due to the heavy nature of the shame and secret surveys, I fell behind almost because over 10,000 people have taken the survey, and I fell behind about 3.5 years in the surveys. And then I decided, you know, some of those people whose surveys I'm reading might not even be listening anymore. So I jumped forward to surveys from 2023. So yes, I'm reading fairly current ones filled out maybe within the last 6 months. And again, there's too many surveys for me to read all of them on air. But once I catch up, which I feel like I will probably do, then I'll go back into that 3.5 year gap and start reading those. So I hope that answers your question. Oh, I am not organized. This is from also from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Nikki. And she writes, how did you open yourself up to dating after your divorce and going through recovery? Specifically, how have you brought up cohabitating with romantic partners and been honest about not wanting to live together without being offensive? And then she shares some of her stories. She lived with an emotionally abusive, did not live with an emotionally abusive partner who was not present, was really kind of emotionally, emotionally abusive, emotionally ignorant, and would guilt her into not wanting to live together. And she did eventually leave that. And she writes, I'm running into a recent issue where someone has expressed their romantic interest in me. I immediately recoiled and felt myself get defensive. In parentheses, I'm working through this with my therapist. I told this person that I am not interested or ready for any type of romantic connection, and they respected that. However, in a separate conversation, they brought up the topic of cohabitating with partners, and I expressed that living with someone is something I can't see for myself. I could tell that their demeanor changed, and they started asking questions like, how can you skip an important milestone like that in a relationship? The feeling of shame and guilt, the exact same feeling I had when my ex was questioning why I didn't want to live together, came up. I can't tell if me not wanting to share a living space with someone is a defensive mechanism from my previous relationship, a result of all my trauma, or if it's a preference. Sometimes when I settle on it being a preference, I almost feel guilty and selfish for it, like something is wrong with me because I can't do what everyone else does. I often question, is it actually okay for me to want to live on my own without someone there? It's a really shitty feeling because I feel happiest when I am alone in my own space, not in an isolating way, but in a way where I recharge best when I am by myself. I love my independence and freedom, especially after enduring the controlling and abusive behaviors of my ex and other male partners in the past. I am happiest when I am by myself, and I think that's okay. Why do others think it isn't? Is it because of societal standards? that as a woman I cannot have my own independence? Is it an avoidant tactic after all the abuse I endured? If I were a man, would the conversation be different, and would I be congratulated for being a, quote, strong bachelor who values his independence, unquote? Can you shed any light on how you've navigated romantic connections during your recovery and how you stand firm on living on your own? Well, for one, I was very transparent with my girlfriend. We've been together 5.5 years, and on our second date, I said that I did not want to get married again and did not want to live with someone again, and that I would totally understand if that was a deal breaker for her. It wasn't, and she respects it. She does not try to guilt me. She doesn't bring it up, and we have a lot of intimacy. You know, there's nothing wrong with being the type of person that wants their own space, and feels their battery being recharged by living on their own. I think one of the most important things is the quality of the time that you spend with each other. When she comes over on the weekend, I'm excited to see her. I'm present. Yeah, there's been a couple of times where, you know, maybe I'm checked out or something, but she will gently let me know, hey, you're not really present. And I respect that, and I adjust accordingly. But 99% of the time, we're present, we're connected, and there's a lot of affection, and we feel like a team. And I think that is, at least to me, is more important than whether or not you're, you know, sharing a bathroom or splitting the rent. It's just, and I did have to work through this with the therapist because I did feel guilty. And I was like, is this me avoiding intimacy? But I think part of recovery is identifying what your needs and preferences are while also processing your trauma and your issues. And eventually you'll get more clarity on those things. So I don't know if that answers your question, but when you're feeling happy and independent, that to me is a good sign that you are respecting your own preferences. And if somebody tries to guilt you about that, that to me is a red flag. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by the People's Pleaser. Love that name. She writes, I was listening to one of your older podcasts from 2016. On this episode was a survey of a young female talking about her mom calling her over and over. It was just a small part of her survey, but it made you pause and give your thoughts about that piece. You said it is emotionally abusive for a mother to need their child so desperately to call over and over. Also, let me add, for father as well, or any caregiver. You also said things like, when a child takes care of a parent's needs, they turn off those needs for themselves and the child dissociates and can't feel inside their body. Anyway, when I heard this, my world came crashing. I have a terrible relationship with my mother. She calls me repeatedly. If I don't answer, I have rescued, counseled, advised. I'm sorry, she calls me repeatedly if I don't answer, period. I have rescued, counseled, advised, you name it, for her for years. I've encouraged her over and over to get help. She doesn't. When I heard you say this, I felt so seen and started weeping. As I was feeling these words, she called. For some reason, because of what you said, I was feeling resourced and curious to see if this phone call would validate my feelings further. It did. She needed me to help her research a new job she was interviewing for. I stood up for myself and told her she can do that for herself. She was huffy and annoyed, and the call was cut short. When I hung up, instead of feeling bad, I laughed. This was huge for me. My therapist has been trying to get me to feel in my body for years. I'm so dissociated that I've been very confused by somatic experiencing. Since I listened to that survey in early February, I have made more progress in therapy in the last month than I have in 10 years. Thank you so much for this awfulsome moment. It was so hard and yet so pivotal and freeing. That made my day. That absolutely made my day. Does that make me a people pleaser? Maybe it does. But yeah, man, that is... It is hard when you have been raised to put a parent's needs ahead of yourself, to emotionally caretake them, to break that pattern. It's so deeply entrenched, but it's so freeing when you do it. I remember the first time, one of the things that my mom would do is if I didn't agree with her on something, she would badger me until I agreed with her, and sometimes she would even begin to cry. And I remember saying, "You can cry if you want, but I'm not changing my mind." And it was almost like a light switch turned off and she just stopped crying. And I went, "Oh my God, this was like a manipulative performance that she had done." And when I hung up the phone, I felt like I was 13 feet tall and I hit my head on the doorway. We are going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors. This episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. You guys know how much my dog Gracie means to me. Now, imagine this. Imagine that you have a Gracie in your life and you're at the vet's office. And all of a sudden you get a bill for a couple of grand. Well, if you had pet insurance, your pet could be covered for accidents or illnesses. And that's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. This episode is sponsored by Cerebral. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online, you'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both, in a safe and judgment-free space. And judgment-free is definitely how I would describe the sessions that I've had with my cerebral therapist. Her name is Megan. She is thoughtful, she is empathetic, and she's knowledgeable, and she's been helping me clarify baby steps I can take to help achieve the professional goals that I am trying to set. I'm a big fan. All cerebral clinicians are vetted, credentialed, and trained to help you feel better. They stay up to date on the latest studies and breakthroughs so they can provide quality care that's based on rigorous research. To get started on your path towards better mental health, Cerebral is giving our listeners 15% off the first month of online therapy, medication, or both. Get started at cerebral.com/podcast. And use the code MENTAL. That's Cerebral, CEREBRAL.com/podcast, and then use the code MENTAL to get 15% off your first month. Make 2024 your best year yet. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. See site for details. And then finally, this is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Fish In, and he has a lot of struggles. Manic depression, anxiety, alcoholism, drug addiction, eating disorders, PTSD, being a sex crime victim, anger issues, and a snapshot from his life. In times of extreme stress, my head feels like a helium balloon on a string, and I'm walking through the fucking zoo. Occasionally, it's full and proud, but more often than not, it floats sullenly and half deflated while cursing the weight of the string.
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out.
All my alters have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lies.
A kind pimp.
Yes.
The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, you first. And I said, I might be gay. I was with a girl. And I said, and what do you have to tell me? She said, I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session.
I'm here with Margot Steinis. First of all, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And hopefully we'll get you out of here in time to get to the airport. I'm just going to read to introduce you. I'm just going to read what your publicist wrote when she pitched you. Reaching out to see if you might be interested in chatting with dominatrix turned metal worker turned memoirist about her experience searching out pain as a means to lose herself in a moment. From working as a New York City high-rise welder, a dominatrix and sex worker, to farming upstate and running, in the parentheses, plus MMA, on a broken ankle. Steinis has been unsparing and uncompromising in answering her own compulsions. And you've got a book called Brutalities, A Love Story, and it is out currently. And it got a glowing review from the New York Times. Steinis manages to keep her reader close, writing with rare crystalline, is it crystalline or crystalline, precision as she explores her fixation with violence and with certain forms of traditional masculinity. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where do we begin? Well, one of the things that I like to ask my guests before we get into their adulthood is, you know, what was childhood like within the family, outside the family, your view of yourself and the world around you, coping mechanisms, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, I think largely I had what you would call a good childhood. I have parents who have been married for, you know, 40 plus years who are, you know, like functional, kind people. There was no chaos in my home. I grew up with a relative amount of class privilege. I went to private school. I think I was given like a lot of opportunities to have, a well-adjusted life, but I, you know, from my earliest memories, never really felt all right. And, you know, I'm born in the 80s. So like we didn't necessarily have the same discourse about mental health that we do now, certainly in children.
In what state or city were you raised?
I grew up in New York City.
Okay.
Yeah. So like I started going to therapy very young, but I think, and, you know, I mean, I think it was clear that I was depressed from a young age, but I do think that if I were a child now, like the way I might have been intervened upon might have been different. But yeah, so I grew up downtown Manhattan, and my father is a professor and a lawyer. And, you know, I was a city kid. in all senses of the word. And then I really just started having problems really young.
How did your depression manifest itself?
I mean, looking back, I don't really remember it that clearly as a small child, but I always just had a lot of social anxiety. Like, I didn't feel comfortable around people, didn't really necessarily feel comfortable in my family, but because I didn't have anything to compare it to, I felt uncomfortable all the time. I'm the oldest of three, so I didn't have like an older sibling's experience to look at. And then, you know, when I got a little older, it was all the like acting out. You know, I was like, got into drugs and got into sexuality really young, and was like, you know, stealing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And what age did that begin to the acting out?
So I developed a pretty severe eating disorder probably first. That was probably the first thing. And that was around, I think it started when I was like around 11 or 12. Okay. And got pretty bad by the time I was like 13.
And were you modeling what peers were doing around you? Was it you kind of came up with it yourself?
No, I think I absorbed a lot from the culture. And I think that one of the, you know, downsides of all of the like awareness raising around eating disorders is like, oh, here's an option of some things you can do. But, you know, I didn't grow up in a family that had problematic values around body size. Like, that didn't come from my family of origin. I feel like some of it just came from the culture. And, you know, like, I grew up in Manhattan. It's like the skinniest place in the world. So there's that.
And what was the payoff for you? Was it restricting, purging, combination?
I had severe anorexia that then like turned into bulimia, and then I kind of had alternating both.
What were the payoffs that you were searching for in those? And I like to call them coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the right word would be for it, but what feelings or thoughts were the payoff for you in doing this?
I mean, you know, to look back now, I think like the cliche that it's all about control was probably true for me. At the time, it did not feel like that. At the time, it really did feel like it was about my body and like very much about like making myself acceptable in a certain way.
Would you get positive compliments from people?
Yeah, for sure. And like, I definitely started kind of getting by on my looks very young. And again, like, I think growing up in the city, like, you are just being appraised a lot on the street. And so I grew up, you know, sort of understanding that the way I looked would allow me to receive things. But, you know, like, making myself excessively thin didn't necessarily like increase that. So like, there were some holes in the logic there.
Gotcha.
But I think also looking back, something that I was unwilling to admit to myself at the time was that I was unwell prior to that. And by shrinking my body, people paid attention to it. People got concerned all of a sudden when like people were not really concerned when I was just like quiet and sad. So there was that.
And was that something that felt good to you, the concern?
Yes and no, because like I wanted it, and then it also felt intolerable. And then, so in my family, when you have a problem, you get sent to a place to have it dealt with. And that I did not like at all.
One of the things that people often say in the surveys are a big part of the anonymously filled out surveys are a big part of the podcast. And one of the things that people share frequently is that they fantasize about having some type of sickness or injury where they can just be in a hospital bed and receive compassion, attention, et cetera.
Totally. Yeah. But the problem is, at least to my experience, when you go to an institution, that's not what you actually receive.
Right. Yes. That's another survey, is the hospitalization. And the majority of people do not have a positive experience. But for some, it can be positively life-changing. And interestingly enough, it usually has to do with the compassion and attention and humanizing that they experience there, where they're not treated like, you know, a widget on a factory line, but a person, not just a set of issues.
Yeah.
So you began acting out in your teen years?
Barely. Yeah, I went to boarding school when I was 13. And
what was that like?
I did not fit well there at all. I was, you know, psychologically fragile and like weird. And
that seems like a really fucked up place for that.
Yeah. And it
the
was
Lord
like
of the
very,
Flies.
Yeah, it was like New England, like a very competitive boarding school, like success, success, success. And, you know, I hadn't really developed into myself as an artist yet, but I think already I was like weird in the way of an artist. And so I just like didn't fit in with the boat shoes, which now I'm glad for.
I love that phrase.
Yeah, I have a very low amount of interest for that people of that milieu. So like I am grateful and I think it speaks well to my personality that I didn't fit in better. But at the time, as a young person, like, you know, you want to kind of find your people, and my people were not there.
So what were some of your first artistic projects that you look back at now, and perhaps there's a way of you saying, oh, here's what I was trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, I was really suppressed as a creative for a long time. I remember when I was like maybe 19, writing. I tried to go to college. I was really messed up with drugs at the time, but I had this professor that I met that he was like, you're a writer. And he was really the first person that made clear to me that I could write about my actual experiences and that I didn't need to sort of sanitize it. And, you know, he probably changed the course of my life by doing that. And so I started trying to write, and, you know, I was not really in my right head. I'd be curious to read some of it now. I have a feeling it was not very good. But I was like, I'm a writer. And then life got messy in a different way, and I kind of shifted gears and like really forgot that that had happened for a long time.
What was the first unsanitized thing you remember putting into your writing?
Well, I was working as a sex worker and doing a lot of drugs. So just that.
And how old were you when that started?
I started working when I was 17.
That's kind of heartbreaking.
I don't know if that's the word I would use, but it's definitely problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the average person hearing that, 17, and I don't know why it's only a year apart, but
yeah.
17 just seems like so much worse than 18, you know, legality aside. I suppose that's just because in our mind we're like, well, that one's wrong and the other, and they're free to do the other.
For sure.
When in reality, you probably haven't changed that much emotionally between 17
and
18.
Like, I don't know, a Manhattan 17 is probably like a Midwest 20. So like there's that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there, I by no means condemn the adult industry, but it was definitely a young start.
And if you're comfortable being specific about the drug use and specific about the sex work, can you talk about it to the degree that you're comfortable?
Oh yeah, no, sure. I mean, I wrote a whole book about it. I worked as a professional dominatrix. I don't know how many details you want. And then I did every kind of drug that was available for purchase at that time, which...
heroin?
Yeah. Yeah.
So would you nod out with the whip in your hand?
No. You know, it's funny. The time when I was doing heroin was mostly... I was not doing sex work. I did sex work for some years and then like sort of stopped for a while and was like trying to waitress. I couldn't get it together to do anything when I was doing heroin. I just really did heroin.
Waiting tables is one of the most difficult jobs I have ever had.
I was so bad at it. Like, so bad at it.
Share a bit about being a dominatrix. I'm kind of, pain is not my thing. So it's not something that I think about a lot or fantasize about, but when somebody shares about it, either being the client or the provider, I don't know what the word would be.
That's what we say.
Yeah. I'm always kind of curious about it? What were the parts of it that you disliked the least, or perhaps even liked, and what were the parts of it that you disliked the most? And how did you get into it?
So I got into it, I met a man on the street who offered me a job, and I was very much like tuned towards chaos at the time. Like, it wasn't like I don't feel like I was coerced into it. I do feel like there was for sure an element of exploitation because of how young I was and because of how sort of calculated his like recruitment of me was.
How did that conversation go? And hold the thought of where you're going with this, but I don't want to forget to ask the question, but what did that pitch sound like?
What's funny, I wrote this scene in the book. He was like, "You're very pretty. Like, would you like a job?" And I was like, "What kind of job?" And, you know, I was interested in money and I was interested in anything sort of deviant. And I didn't really understand like what his business was, but I was definitely like curious enough to find out. And I do think that had I not started working for him, I probably would have started working in some similar or adjacent capacity sooner or later.
Similar what?
Similar or adjacent capacity.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Because I was like very sexually curious and I was also very disassociated from myself on a lot of levels. So to me, to like, you know, like sex work didn't feel like a encroachment on anything. And it didn't feel like a lot of the narratives that I think people who are, you know, against it put on women who do it, like just didn't feel true for me. Like I don't really feel like I was victimized by anything, even though I was very young.
What do you think, other than the money, did you enjoy the control?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff about it I liked. I thought, you know, for a long time I sort of convinced myself that it was just about the money. And then I got to a point where I wanted to stop and I like couldn't make myself stop. And I was like, oh, something else is going on
because of the
here.
Money or because no, there was
no,
a rush?
No, I was really... like this particular kind of attention that I received, like filled something for me that really needed filling. And I liked the dynamic of like, you know, like people call it like power exchange, whatever, energy exchange. Like I liked fucking with people and I liked I liked the intensity of it. And you know, like, did I like it sexually? Like, no, not usually, but sometimes. But like, did I get something from it? Did it make me feel high? Like, absolutely.
And in a way, that's not surprising because I think when you are a depressive person or you feel dissociated, there's a numbness.
Yes.
And oftentimes we seek out things that are intense.
Yes.
And one of the things that's problematic with that is then our baseline stimulation is so hard to match in other areas of our lives that it just feels like the world is black and white until we're high or we're overspending or we're acting out sexually, you know, whatever that may be. So if you're comfortable sharing, and it seems like you are, what a session may look like from the most innocuous one to perhaps the most intense one.
I mean, they're so varied. It's really hard to do that. Human beings are very unique in their sexual appetites. But as someone at my reading, I think very astutely said last night, they said, like, you get paid a lot of money to force men to do exactly what they want. That's, like, basically the job. Yeah.
And the kind of the stereotype or the thing that you hear about a lot with men that want to be a submissive is that they want to let go of all the power and decision-making they do during the day in their high-power jobs. Mm-hmm. Is that a cliche or is that kind of common?
I mean, it's a cliche for a reason, like many. Like, that was definitely true. But it's also, like, who has the financial privilege to hire people? Like, it's not, like, an inexpensive hobby. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there are probably a lot of people who are interested in the same kind of dynamic but can't pursue it professionally because it's really expensive. And it's like, you know, if you're like just like a man especially if you're not like a particularly attractive man, like it's kind of hard to arrange such things without financial exchange, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's why like that demographic is a little overrepresented.
And what kind of money would you make for a session? Would it depend on what you were doing?
I think I charged like, I mean, it definitely, I can't remember when I started. I think when I stopped, I charged like $300 an hour, mm-hmm. which now I'm like, that wasn't enough.
and this was in,
but this was like,
what years?
Let's see. This is, I stopped when I was in my late 20s. So like about 15 years ago.
Okay.
So maybe it was enough. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. And so, and I apologize if these are too graphic of questions. Would you be touched or would you only touch them or was there not even touching other than, you know, inflicting pain or whatever?
Like, so people who work in professional S&M tend to sort of separate themselves for better or for worse from other types of sex workers, which is something that I've really had to unpack for myself, and look at all the internalized stigma and the way that, you know, we sort of turn on each other. So anyway, all of which is to say, like, at the time, my sort of professional standard was like, basically, like, no one touches me. Though I also did a lot of work, just not the kind of work I advertised, that had different boundaries. But that's the, you know, if you're asking like what the sort of standard operating procedure is, like that's how most people work, or at least like on the forward facing, like the forward facing face of their business is that.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah.
So
you definitely want to charge a lot more if you're
being
yeah.
touched.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what led you or enabled you to finally overcome the addiction to it? I don't know what word you would use. You were saying earlier that it was kind of hard to quit because there was an aspect of it that was compulsive.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't realize it for so long because I had just done it for so long. But I, you know, for a variety of reasons, started wanting a civilian career. And I started, you know, I went to school for metalwork. I had a job as a metalworker and I kept, you know, just a handful of clients. And I was kind of like slowly phasing them out. And like each one was harder to let go of than the last. And like the last one, I would like make appointments and cancel them. And then like just, I remember like laying in my bed being like, you have to get in the cab in 2 hours, you have to get in the cab in 1 hour, and by the time I had to get in the cab, I was like, I just couldn't move. And so it was like this like friction between like what I wanted to do and what I wanted to do, right? Like the big picture, the macro and the micro. And I mean, I think I was like habituated on it. That's probably the word I would use. I don't know if you can get addicted to stuff like that, but it was just, I didn't really know who I was without having that input.
What made the last one to be let go of different from the first one you let go of?
He was like my longest term client, my most generous client, the sort of easiest one to, it's just like the clingiest one probably.
There we go. The codependent dominatrix.
Yeah.
When you would share, if you shared what you were doing professionally with friends, family, whatever, what was the reaction? Did your family ever know? And I hope it doesn't sound like I'm stigmatizing it. I just kind of want to know the context of the world around you as you were doing this outside of the performance, whatever session, whatever you call it.
Yeah. So I was like, my work was very secretive for the first like maybe 2 years because I was so young. And then I was out as a sex worker for like most of the time. And you know, I didn't like, it was definitely something my family was very uncomfortable with. So I certainly didn't like throw it in their face. I can't remember how they found out. But
and was it legal once you were 18?
Yeah. So the premise of a BDSM business in New York State is legal. Like, some of the activities that go on in it are not. So it's like exists in a sort of gray area. So it's like legal-ish.
Gotcha.
And yeah, I mean, I was out pretty much everywhere. I always, you know, I always had like a fake job that I would cite if I had to, I don't know, like do something where I felt like the stigma was going to be too much to bear. But by and large, I was out, and that felt important to me. And it feels, you know, at the time I wasn't very, I hadn't been like, my political awakening hadn't happened yet, but it now, you know, I was someone who had the privilege to be able to live as out as a sex worker. And I do feel like that is a politically important thing to do.
Because it makes it easier for people in that line of work to feel less shame.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I think like the more people know who do that work, the less, like, I think it just like helps to break down stigma a little bit, which I do think is important.
Let's talk about the metal work.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated, and welding is something that I've always wished that I knew how to do. Talk about what got you into it, what you love about it. And there's two kinds. There's TIG and MIG. Is that right?
There are three kinds and then some specialty kinds. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about it. Geek out.
Yeah, so I started doing metalwork because I had this boyfriend who I really idolized, who was...
And you're how old at this point?
That's a good question. I was like mid-20s.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I got sober when I was 23. I was probably like 25 maybe.
Are you still sober?
Yeah.
Kudos.
Yeah. Since 2006.
Awesome.
I really idolized him. He was a steel contractor, and he was not very nice to me. And my work was like one of the things that he sort of used the most to like make me feel shitty about myself. And I really just wanted to like reinvent myself in a way that he would respect. And I was like, I'm going to do what he does, because then he will think I'm a viable person. And then I fucking did.
And did he come around his opinion or view, or just pick apart what you were doing?
I think he was, I do think that, like, you know, he helped me a lot in the beginning of my career. He helped me. It's something I try to not forget, because, you know, he harmed me a lot, but he also helped me a lot. And he encouraged me to get started. He gave me contacts. Like, he helped me get some early jobs. Yeah, I mean, I think in general he was like, I don't know if he was proud of me or whatever, but like the idea that I would become a person that he would treat as an equal, like, no, that didn't have anything to do with my work. That was just a sort of sight for that. But, you know, it did give me, metalwork was really good for me.
And were you just doing commercial work? Were you doing any kind of creative?
No, you know, I never did really anything creative as a metal worker, which now I'm like, oh, that was such a missed opportunity. But I have to say, like, after you weld on a job site for 10 hours a day, the last fucking thing you want to do on a Sunday is, like, more welding, or for me at least. I would love if I had a shop now to just noodle around, but not quite enough to, like, build one.
When people who are just starting out in comedy ask if I would be interested in coming to the open mic and in watching, I say, I love you, I care about you, but that is like asking somebody who works at a paint store for 10 hours a day to come hang out in the paint store.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think once you professionalize anything, it changes the joy of it. Do you know what I mean?
It does. It does. So you were a high-rise welder? Is that
yeah, so I started out, my first job was in this incredible shop in Brooklyn it's still going strong, a high-end architectural fabrication shop. So they make, like, really beautiful stairs, doors, that kind of thing. And that's where I learned to weld. They taught me to weld. And they were really, really wonderful. Like, that job really changed my life. I went in there and, you know, with my ex's contact and asked if I could work for free. And they were like, I don't know. And then they let me, and then they started paying me in a couple of weeks, and they were just really kind to me.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah. And, you know, I met a friend there who's still a dear friend who taught me how to weld and mentored me. And then after that, I got a union apprenticeship, which is like a lot more money. So I took that, and that's when I became an iron worker. And I did 3 years of union apprenticeship working on high-rise buildings, and then earned my journeyman iron workers card and did that work for most of the rest of my time in metal. And then after a certain point, there were things about like the union sites and just like all of the men that became just a lot. And so I started working freelance.
Hold that thought. What is the most difficult metal to weld, and what was your favorite type of metal to weld?
Well, I don't weld all the specialty metals. Like, I don't know what titanium is like. For me, aluminum is the hardest. A lot of people who do aluminum welding really specialize in that and do just that. But it's, I don't know, I always found it very, very challenging.
Because it's hard to get a good bond or to get a clean, aesthetically pleasing bond.
Well, it's kind of the same thing, but no, it doesn't melt the same way that steel or stainless steel does. So it's like, it just gets kind of globby.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's the easiest one? Iron?
Mild steel. Yeah.
What do you mean mild steel?
It's what you mean.
Okay. Yeah. So talk about the job site. Give me some snapshots that you think kind of representative of your experience. Would you be the sole female on these sites?
Usually there would be a handful of other women in other trades on the sites. I had one company I worked for where there was a woman journeyman in my who worked for my company, but that was the only time. So... And, you know, I will preface this by saying, like, at the time I started working on these sites, I was, like, not well mentally. Like, I was, like, suffering a lot in my eating disorder and just, like, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, very hard to show up for shit. And so...
That's good to be dizzy in a high rise.
Yeah, totally. And honestly, like, I was... People ask me, like, are you afraid of heights? And I'm like, you know, I don't think so. I don't even know, because I was so afraid of being embarrassed that I didn't even perceive
that
any
was
other
a bigger
fear. For sure. Yeah. I didn't want the men to think I was weak. So, you know, I would show up at 6:30 in the morning on some huge building that's like marginally constructed with like a couple thousand men. And everyone's like staring, you know. And I just tried to, like, I had my head shaved and, you know, wore, like, baggy clothes and tried to, I just really wanted to be, like, one of them, you know. I tried to blend as best I could. And that was kind of the vibe, you know. Like, I've worked on jobs where, like, there's no bathroom for me to use. And because New York State is a good union state, like, and our union was a good one, there was a palpable fear of being accused of sexual harassment. So I was largely left alone, and I never felt like unsafe at work, but there was so much, I mean, weird dynamics of like being undermined and, you know, being treated like I was a diversity hire and shit like that. And then there were also people who were wonderful, you know, who mentored me and, you know, treated me like any other apprentice. The other thing is like every kind of apprentice gets hazed, and mm-hmm. you have to get the you get the coffee. That's your job. So it's like, again, going back to like, I'm not a very good waitress. So like you have to take the coffee order for like 200 men
on
a little notebook. And then you have to carry it back in a little crate with a shopping cart. And I'm like, don't treat me like a waitress. I'm a welder. But like everyone does it their first year. And then if you get anybody's coffee wrong, they fucking hate you. So that was like my first year. And then you like, you know, progress past that and they let you do more work. And I knew how to weld when I started, which like not everyone does. So I did get to do more of that, but you know.
So what's next after the metal work? How did you transition out of that? And I want to kind of transition into the paint.
Yeah.
The physical pain and you finding that to be healing? How did that come about?
Well, I moved to Hawaii after my ex left me.
Which island?
Oahu.
Okay.
And like immediately after he left me.
North Shore, Honolulu?
South Shore, Waimanalo.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was working on cranes as a metal worker there for a while, did some buildings there. And, you know, it was really like that was one of the main pivot points of my life. Now looking back was like when he left me, because my whole life was wrapped up with him. And it was a very unhealthy relationship that kind of consumed me. And I didn't really know who I was outside of it. So I moved as far away as I could get myself. And, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was like living in a shed with no electricity or plumbing on my friend's land and working on his farm for food. And it was one of the happiest periods of my life, actually. But, you know, I was like, oh, I have to like make some money so I can buy gas. And so I was doing metal work for that. But I just I started feeling increasingly like I didn't want to do it forever, which is like not a thing I had felt before. And physically, I was like, this shit is really hard. Like, I don't know if I want to do something so hard always. And it was kind of the first time I'd had that feeling. And then I don't really know why, but I started going to school. I had dropped out of college a long time prior. And I started going to school. And that just kind of set things in motion for me. And I guess the part I left out is like, so I wrote a book in, I don't know what year it was, but probably like a couple years before my ex left me. And I had been working on this book. I had an agent and I had been like editing it and working towards like potentially shopping it this whole time. And so when I started going to school again, like I had been writing and, you know, I met all these mentors and like studied writing as a 35-year-old undergraduate, mm-hmm. or I guess I was 30 at the time. And so I just, like, that felt like something I wanted to be doing. And then my friend was like, you should do an MFA. And I was like, I don't have any money for that. And she was like, no, they'll pay you. And I was like, oh, okay. and then I applied to MFAs. I didn't really understand that, like, you could get funding for graduate school.
Back to the, and hold that thought where we are, the breakup. Did he give a reason? Was there any part of you that was relieved, or was it all just he left me, you know?
Oh, I was really devastated. We had a terrible relationship and it was like absolutely the right thing and we should have split up many years prior. But, and he was like, had tried to leave me for years and I was like fucking Velcro. But no, I was not relieved. I like felt like I was going to die.
What were the ways that you Velcroed when he would try to leave?
Oh, like I would like hold on to the door of his truck as he physically tried to drive away.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is awful.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like very dysfunctional.
Give me some other ways.
I mean, I just.
Would you emotionally, you know, say and things to make him feel guilty or worried about your safety?
No, he wasn't susceptible to anything like that. No, it was more like we had a really dysfunctional connection that was like largely based on sex. And then he really liked being mean to me and I would just tolerate any treatment that he gave me. And, you know, he would be horrible to me and then I would be like, okay.
For instance, what would he do or say?
He was, like, just really cruel verbally, yeah.
Any particular thing you can recall him saying, whether it's verbatim or not?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to – I don't know if I want to – I think I'm good on that. Okay. But he was just, like, he's a really – he can be a really mean person.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about pain. Were you aware that – is the word like pain – would that be a fair assessment of your relationship with it, that you found something attractive or helpful about
it?
Yeah,
for sure. I mean, I think that elides a lot of nuance, but yeah, I mean, I was like pretty deeply involved in BDSM for a long time.
But you were the one inflicting the pain.
But that was my work. I'm like in my personal life. And in, I see. Yeah. Yeah, I was like.
Was that there before you started doing sex work?
No.
Okay.
No.
Did kind of a light bulb go off in your head during the sex work?
No, it was when I met this
man. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. And I met him when I was very young also.
And it was it that was his kink?
Yeah. Like we definitely had a relationship that was predicated on, you know, consensual violence.
And did you like it right away or were you?
Yeah. I was like, oh, I've been paying all this money for these drugs and this is free. Yeah, I really just wanted to get out of myself. And, you know, whether it was, you know, starvation or food or, you know, drugs or whatever, like, you know, I remember being young and just like hitting my head against the wall because I was like, you know, that feels better. And then the other thing is like I was really heavily medicated as a young person by a series of psychiatrists. In a way that I now see as like pretty inappropriate. So like nothing really felt like anything mentally, physically or otherwise. So like the first time I got punched in the face, I was like, oh, that feels like something, you know, and like we all want something that feels like something. And I think because that space had been kind of normalized to me from my work, it just kind of all fell together like that.
Was the punch in the face consensual?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Somebody said one time, I'm addicted to oblivion. And I thought, wow, that sums it up. Whether it's a video game.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's, I want out.
Yeah.
I don't care what the exit door looks like.
Totally.
I want out. Not to die.
Yeah. But to be in the in-between.
To be in the in-between. Yeah. That's such a great way of putting it. So talk about your relationship with pain.
I mean, I think I had the way that I treated my body around eating was probably like my first experience of that. Of like, I was in a lot of physical pain from a young age because I was just like really fucking hungry all the time. And then, you know, when I sort of discovered S&M, it was like, oh, now here's a space where like I don't have to be in charge of that. And someone, I'm like, I can sort of receive that. And then with drugs, it was kind of the same where it's like, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, drugs. I found the way that I use drugs was very painful. I was like, okay, it could have been better managed. And, you know, I think that I also have always been and remain very interested in sort of like the edges of like the edges of people, myself included. And I do think, you know, and I've read a lot like about pain as sort of like a space where we find out sort of where we end. And it is, you know, it's very consuming. Like a writer that I love describes it as like when we're in pain, the world is remade, right? And I was very interested in that because the world I was in didn't feel good. And so this other one, and especially one that, like, I had, you know, like, facilitated in some way and chosen for myself, like, that felt good. That felt – if it didn't physically feel good, it felt, like, satisfying. Do you know?
Was it the dopamine as a result of the physical reception of pain that was the payoff, or was it the intellectual or both?
I mean, I think both. Like, I'm not a neuroscientist, clearly. But, yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, I mean, I've done enough drugs to be like, oh, like, I can sort of relate different feelings to different substances. And, like, it definitely feels like you've ingested a substance. Like, you know, yeah.
I needed a root canal once and was in a lot of pain. And I remember being in the pharmacy and just like looking at a Rubik's cube. And I was like, I really want to get into that. I'm going to buy that. And then a couple of days later, after the pain left, looking at it like, what the fuck was I thinking? And I went, oh, I think I might have been a little high from the pain.
Yeah, for sure.
Not the pain meds. I hadn't taken them yet, but the pain. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what people.
Yeah. And that's something that I actually like noticed when I first started. I got really into tattooing when I was young, and I would like sit and get tattooed for a really long time. And I remember being like, I'm all fucked up, you
in
know,
a good
just
way?
From sitting there. I mean, yeah, like at the time, like there was no bad way. Do you know what I mean? Like I liked any kind of altered feeling. And, you know, in my later life, I have like a pretty intense relationship with exercise that has like provided many like similar feelings. So
talk about the running on the broken ankle.
It was my heel, not my ankle. Okay. But I, you know, I think I have recently learned that there's no actual diagnostic criteria for exercise addiction, but like I think I clearly had it. And I started running like in my late 20s, I think, and just got obsessed with it. And it became a way to order my life and a way to feel intensity and feel a sense of like mastery over myself. And so like I want as much of that as possible. And I did not know a lot about how to. And some of it was I didn't know, and some of it was just like I didn't bother to like, you know, properly fuel myself and like, you know, take a rest day and stuff like that. Like it wasn't very strategic. So I got a stress fracture and I knew something was wrong, but I didn't want to deal with it. So I just kept running on it for some time.
And would you feel differently after running with the injured heel than you did just running without pain in your heel?
Yeah, I mean, it hurt, but like one of the things that I have always loved so much about running is like whatever hurts, like whether, like I ran a marathon with a flu once and it's like on, like after mile three, it's like I don't have the flu anymore. Like I don't feel fucking anything except like this specific kind of pain that I have chosen for the day. And you know, it's the same. And that I think is like very much a neurological phenomenon where like, you know, most, many injuries up to a certain threshold, you really don't feel when you're doing the thing. It would be like afterwards, it would be like something's not right.
Comedians talk often about that, and I've experienced it where you have a cold or the flu or something and you go on stage and for that 45 minutes you're not even aware of it.
Yeah, it gets overridden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've talked about having an addiction to various things or compulsive aspect of your personality. What are the things today that you struggle with moderation of?
You know, it's funny. I don't have a lot going on. I work in a way that is often unmanageable.
Workaholism? Is that too strong of a word?
I mean, I think I definitely have tendencies. I definitely have tendencies, but I do think I've also, I think having a child really changed me, probably like neurochemically, but certainly in terms of the choices I make. And I have a sense of self-preservation that does feel new. So I don't have a thing. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Work is the closest thing to a thing that I have. But I will say like my boyfriend would say, like, I am very regimented in how I do things, and I have set up a lot of systems of order for myself that for me serve to mitigate the latent but still existent desires to be like completely fucking chaotic.
Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I think you covered so much. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you being so open about all these things. And your book is called Brutality is a Love Story. And it's out there. It's available. And where can people find you on social media if you're on social media?
Yeah, I am on Twitter at my name, Margo Sinus. And I'm on Instagram at Red State Blues. And I have a website that is myname.com.
And her name is spelled MargoSteines. Thanks so much, Margo.
Thanks.
Many, many thanks to Margo. And as we do every episode, we put the links to our guests' stuff. And we put links to our advertisers. And a really important part of this podcast trying to sustain itself is you guys using the products that we advertise. And It greatly helps if you use the personalized URL that we use when we advertise a product, and we put those in the show notes. So if you're going to use their product, please use the special URL, because if the advertiser gets a good response, there's a good chance they will advertise with us again. And we really need financial support. We're going to pause. Speaking of sponsors, we're going to pause and see if we have any sponsors. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, filled out by a person who does not, they identify as genderqueer. They call themselves Electric Complicated. And they ask, "Hi, Paul, longtime listener, love the show and your info and story with covert incest. It helped me realize the role that it played in my life and my mental illness. My question is about psych meds. I've been on them for a long time and recently tried going off for 4 months. I've become an anxious mess and took my first dose again last night. Can you talk about the role that meds have played in your life? I'm feeling pretty down about this at the moment." First of all, I want to congratulate you on looking at the facts on the ground, which not the facts that you imagine in your brain or wish for, that don't mesh with reality. I have tried to go off my meds before, despite my psychiatrist advising me otherwise, because I don't trust big pharma. I don't like being on meds. You know, I think about, well, what if society breaks down and I can't get them? But one of the things that I've become clear about is, what are the side effects of not being on meds? And for me, it's deep depression, suicidal ideation, and crazy anxiety. And so I stay on them, and they help me function. And from all the psychiatrists that I have talked to, meds, unless someone is in acute crisis, meds should not be the first choice. People should try therapy, support groups, self-care, clean diets, on and on and on and on. But for some of us, that is still not enough. And we do need to do those things. But for some of us, we also need meds. And maybe there will come a time where science will improve and we don't need meds. We can do something. But I hope that answers your question. I always get nervous when I talk about meds and people that want to go off them, but thank you. A really, really important topic and question. And I've seen so many people's life degraded because they don't like the idea of being on meds, and they've tried everything and they refuse to take meds. And some of those people I've had to cut contact with because not because they're simply because they're not taking meds, but because they complain about the same issue that if they went back on meds, it would help manage it. But merely because of the stigma, self-imposed stigma of meds, they refuse to take them. And that to me, it makes no sense, but I also kind of understand it. This is from the Fear Survey, and this is filled out by a non-binary person who uses maybe my favorite name so far. When the going gets tough, the tough gets suicidal. And share something you fear. "I fear that my lifelong search for parental figures, in parentheses, not for biological parents, will impede my ability to form genuine relationships with potential mentors in my life. I'm in graduate school and I want to meet with a lecturer to talk about my career, But I know that on some level, I also want a relationship that they can't give me. I don't know how to navigate that for myself, so instead I don't ask anything. I'm scared my inability to deal will lead to me missing out professionally and personally. A couple of things here that struck me is I think it's healthy to want to have intimacy and to want to have mentors. And one of the things I think to be conscious of is that you seem to be aware of this, is that you're not expecting someone to give you things that you can't. And so then the question is, not getting rid of the desire, the healthy desire for mentorship and intimacy, but saying, how can I get this where I'm not putting it all on one person? And that to me is where support groups or a close-knit group of friends and supporters can help. Two of the guests I've had on this podcast, my mentor Bill and Don Morgan, they're kind of my big brother slash father figures. And yes, there are other people in my support network, but they inspire me, they guide me. And oftentimes, the relationship I have with them, they don't even need to say anything. They inspire me by the way they live their lives. And when we have an expanded group of support, it feeds us in a variety of ways where we're not just depending on a single person and then becoming disappointed in them because they can't be there for us in a way that we need. So I think all of that is to say, I think your desire for that is super healthy and your self-awareness seems really good. And I just want to encourage you to keep searching and just expand your network. I could have said that entire thing in those two sentences, but I'm here to waste your time. I'm here to drain you. You are my mentor and I'm sucking the life out of you. And I hope you're enjoying it. I think it's time that you set a boundary with me, honestly. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a guy who calls himself I'm Funny, I Swear. And he writes, I know you've mentioned a few times that you play hockey. Do you have a favorite team? And I love that he writes that he spells favorite F-A-V-O-U-R-I-T-E. I'm assuming you're Canadian or from the UK. Or maybe Australia. Australia, yes. Anyway, my team is the Chicago Blackhawks. I was born and raised in Chicago and started playing hockey when I was 7 or 8. And they've been my team since then. And for those of you that aren't aware, I don't know why I'm adding this, but they've got a kid. And he is a kid. He's 18 years old. And he is a phenom. He is so exciting to watch. His name's Connor Bedard. And it has reignited my passion for watching the Blackhawks. And the team is terrible. They're at the bottom of the league. But this kid alone is worth the price of admission. If you're curious and you want to see, just go to YouTube and put in Connor Bedard. Highlights. Unbelievable. Super excited for the rebuild that they are underway. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Beth. She identifies as straight and also writes, I enjoy same-sex experiences, but I am romantically straight. She's in her 60s. Says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? She writes, some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. I would say it does. She writes, my wonderful uncle let me, quote, horsey ride, unquote, on a pipe in the milking shed from when I was very young. When he turned on the pump, the pipe would vibrate. I had the most wonderful orgasms, exclamation point. He would watch and smile. That is so creepy. It was our secret for years. Even as an adult, whenever we visit, I go out to the shed with him twice a day and ride that pipe while he watches. I think my aunt has always been aware that we were up to something, but she never came out to check on us. Wow. She is not sure if she's been physically or emotionally abused. Any positive experiences with abusers? I love my uncle and aunt for letting it happen. I do love masturbating. I am grateful for learning about orgasms at such a young age. Darkest thoughts. Being given to a group of men by my partner, I am happy to comply with all their demands. Darkest secrets. When I was with one guy, we realized that several kids were sneaking up to the bedroom window, so we would give them a show. I admit I did things with him just so they could see it. This happened regularly for the 2 years I was with him. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you, submission to either men or women. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Thank you to my uncle for letting me orgasm and watching me without taking it further. What, if anything, do you wish for? Orgasms? Have you shared these things with others? No. How do you feel after writing these things down? Weird. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Do not be ashamed of your needs. Boy, there is so much in that survey that that I don't even know how to put into words as a response. So I'm just going to let the survey speak for itself, because I don't think I can accurately say your experience and your feelings about it are yours. But I think anybody listening to that, it is alarming, and the stuff with the uncle, and I'm not trying to change your mind about how you feel about it. I'm just giving you my perspective, and I want to thank you for sharing that with us. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Doesn't Honey. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? I have a coworker and friend who changed their pronouns last year. When I read their announcement, the voice in my head said, "You are going to fuck up their pronouns." I did, ultimately misgender them without thinking. The voice in my head berated me mercilessly. Now I feel like I have created a stumbling block over this issue. I misgender them. I mercilessly beat myself up. Repeat. I try to comfort myself with the fact that I will not stop trying to use the correct pronouns and that someday it will be second nature to me. Meanwhile, I have this excruciating cycle of thoughts. Everyone thinks you're a transphobe. No, everyone thinks you're old and out of touch. Doesn't have to be one or the other. People can think that you're a transphobe and you're old and out of touch. I picture my friend saying, "Okay, boomer," to me and die of shame inside. You know what I think when I read this? For one, I have done that. And it is shame-inducing, not by the other person's reaction, but just because I feel like I've kicked them in the shin. The most important thing is you are conscious and you are trying to do better, and I think it's time you cut yourself some slack, said the pot to the kettle. This is an email I got from Ronnie Hewitt, and he writes, "Hi, we haven't spoken in a while, but I just saw something online about your website and felt compelled to reach out. It looks like there is some unfavorable news that could be harmful to your reputation. Being aware of how easily stories can get out of hand and wishing not you to be taken by surprise. I decided to warn you. Here's where I found the info. And it's a website, thebestdumptrailers.com/the most lightweight dump trailers for easy transport. I'm hoping it's all a simple confusion, but I believed it necessary you should know. All the best to you, Ronnie. Ronnie, I want to thank you for that, and I assume that you're listening. I went to the dump truck website, and all of this stuff about me is true. I eat entire meals over the sink, just stuffing my Dizzy Gillespie cheeks. When I walk Gracie and I forget to bring poop bags, I bend down and mime like I'm picking it up in case anybody is watching. There's a grocery store, and when I go to, sometimes there's a elderly lady who does the bagging of the groceries. And when she's bagging someone else's groceries, I'm really happy that the store hires seniors. And when she's bagging my groceries, I wish that she had died in her sleep. And probably the most damning thing, Ronnie, that I found on your website, thebestdumptrailers.com, the most lightweight dump trailers for easy transport, is that it has been revealed that I have taken bribes to recommend really bad lightweight dump trailers that are not easy to transport. And I'm deeply ashamed, and I thank you for bringing that to my attention and calling me out, because that's what friends do. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this one, this one is dark, and I labeled it dark because I was going to save this for the next batch. I'm going to do another episode of the darkest surveys, but accidentally put this in this pile, so I'm just going to go ahead and read it. And by the way, if you are not a Patreon donor, at I think it might be the $5 level and above, I read a bonus, a couple of bonus surveys every week. All right. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself Anita Bath. She identifies as straight. She's in her 40s, says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. When my husband was blackout drunk, he raped me. I remember being on our bed and I was insisting, no, no, no. He said, "You're not getting away with it this time." He was much taller and stronger than me. He held me down and started thrusting his penis into my dry vagina. I went completely still and my spirit left my body. I was hovering over the bed watching the whole thing happen. It was like a dream state. The rape wasn't the worst part. I experienced the worst part the following day. The next afternoon, I sat down with him and calmly said that the preceding night he had raped me. He asked, "How does a husband rape a wife? How exactly would that work?" I thought he would have been sorry for his actions. He wasn't. He wasn't taking any responsibility. I felt like he was gaslighting me. He asked, "Are you saying to me that I, your husband, raped you, my wife? Is that what you're saying to me?" Wow. Was he born in the 1870s? Actually, I think it's probably shocking how many people think that if you are in a relationship with someone, that you can't sexually violate them. He was yelling this at me like I had done something wrong. He asked if I was recording the conversation. I said no. Apparently, he didn't believe me because a few minutes later, he smacked my cell phone out of my hand and went flying across the room and he picked it up. I had not been recording. He was simply paranoid. As his drinking and pills increased, he was more and more paranoid. I felt so scared and trapped at that time in my marriage. I felt unsafe. Thank goodness I finally left after 10 years. She's been emotionally abused. My husband picked out most of my clothes, and he told me what to wear to certain functions. He gave very strong opinions about my haircuts and colors. When it came to our home, he did all the decorating. I wasn't allowed to put up even one photo. Once I put a photo on a table in a guest bedroom. The photo was a beautiful shot of my mom and me. Within an hour, it was missing. I asked my husband. He said he took it down because he didn't like it. He didn't like when I went out without him. Sometimes when I would go out to dinner with a girlfriend, he would show up and ask to have dinner with us. Years later, I can see how controlling he was. I can see how compliant I was. Both of us were sick. I pray I never get into this unhealthy dynamic again. I've been going to a 12-step meeting for codependence, and this has been a lifesaver. What a sick, sick, controlling man he was. And I'm so glad that you can see that there was a sickness in you too, because you were, at least at that time, staying with him. And the fact that you are owning your sickness and trying to get better is huge and brave. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yes, I had a lot of good times with my husband. We had some amazing trips, and we used to connect on a deep level before he started mixing opioids with alcohol. My husband is not a bad person. Because of his messed up childhood, he turned to substances to cope. I wish him health and happiness from a distance. Darkest thoughts. 4 years ago, my husband was drinking and taking high amounts of opiates prescribed by his doctor. He was raping me, gaslighting me, and he was awfully paranoid. He thought I was sleeping with his best friend. I was not. He thought that people put microphones in our home so they were listening to us. He thought people were burning our yard. The sun had dried out the grass. He thought that people were scratching his SUV on purpose, and he thought that when I gave him a drink or food, there was poison in it. I think all the paranoia came from the opiates. I told him that if he went to a doctor to get him off the opiates, then I would stay with him. But if he didn't go to that doctor, then I would have to leave him because I felt unsafe. 2 days later, in our bedroom, he shot himself in the head with a handgun. I was right there. I still have PTSD from hearing the bang, smelling the blood, seeing his face. I will spare you the details. I got him into the best hospitals, and they saved his life, even though he will never be the same again. In short, he lived. My deepest, darkest secret is that if my husband had died, my life would be simpler today. Darkest secrets. I've been separated from my husband for 3 years. I have a sober boyfriend now who treats me well. I am not divorcing my husband because I would have to give him nearly all my savings since he is disabled. I don't think that's fair. My husband is an only child, is getting his money from his parents, who are quite wealthy. My parents are struggling financially. I am unwilling to part with my money because he got hopped up on drugs and shot himself in the head. I'm embarrassed that I don't have the courage, the confidence, and the what the fuck do I care to simply go through a divorce and fork over my money to him. These are complicated feelings that keep me up at night. I hope you are working through these and sharing these with your support group, and I imagine you are because you seem to have a lot of clarity and recovery. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. I'm the secretary working on a project late at night in the office. By the way, don't all the sexiest projects go late into the night? The boss is angry with how I messed something up, so he spanks me until he fucks me. What a weird fantasy. I am a feminist! Exclamation point. Actually, and I've talked about this many times, many of the fantasies that feminists have that they have shared via these surveys or people I've interviewed or talked to go against their moral code. And that is very often the nature of our sexual fantasies. Is it something that makes us morally, ethically anxious, or something tied to historical events that have happened to us that fill us with complex, uncomfortable emotions or memories? What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Husband, I have a lovely boyfriend. How about you release me from this marriage? Let's do a divorce in which you keep your money and I keep mine. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace, continual growth in my recovery from codependency. Have you shared these things with others? I haven't shared these things with others. How do you feel after writing these things down? I feel calmer. I have more empathy for myself and my husband. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? The tragedy is now part of your history. However, your tragedy need not define you. You have the power to create your future. The lotus grows out of mud. Thank you for that. And again, I just want to high five you on getting into the solution, no matter how scary it is. And I found your survey to be inspiring. And I would encourage you to open up about the things that you shared in the survey with the stuff around the money and your husband, with someone who has proven themselves to be safe. Probably somebody from your support group or a therapist. And then finally, this is a happy moment filled out by Tony Badacious. And he writes, I used to spend a month or so each summer in Texas with my dad when I was growing up. I remember the long drive from Alabama to Texas and listening to the radio. He listened to talk radio a good bit. Looking back, I was probably getting some secondhand Rush Limbaugh going in one ear and right out the other. I still love the sound of baseball announcers chattering on about stats and the dull static sound of the crowd in the background. I'm not a sports person at all, but I still hunt down a game on the radio at the right time of the year and just zone out while I drive and sit in that feeling of my childhood. He had this late night newspaper gig, and he would have to take me with him. I would wander around this big warehouse while all these dudes would be at their stations stacking and rolling up newspapers and putting them into their plastic bags and rolling off these big carts to their vehicles to load up. He drove an old Lincoln an old Lincoln town car, and the newspapers would be piled up halfway to the ceiling, and I'd ride in the back on top of all these newspapers. God, I love that image. Summer nights in Houston with the windows rolled down, laying on top of these newspapers, the plastic sticking to me, listening to the radio, driving slowly through neighborhood after neighborhood while the sprinklers watered all the lawns. Most nights he'd put on this soft rock station. I first heard Elton John that summer. He made sure to explain to me that he was singing to Daniel, and the song Daniel, because that was his boyfriend. That didn't really matter to me, though. So many great songs, one after the other for hours. Sometimes I'd fall asleep while the pile slowly disappeared. Once I hit my teenage years, things fell apart, but those sweaty summers listening to the radio are golden moments that nothing can tarnish. That was like a little movie. Fuck, I love that. What a picture you painted. Thank you to everybody who fills out surveys or supports the podcast financially and non-financially. Anytime you can spread the word via social media or tell friends about it, all of that stuff helps. And obviously being a financial donor as well. But yeah, if you're out there and you're feeling stuck, never forget you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.